Are you familiar with the famous marshmallow experiment? Have you ever heard of it? It's a wonderful story. There was a research project in which a researcher invited a group of four-year-old children into an empty room. One at a time, the children would come into the room and they would sit at a table there, the only thing that was in the room. And on the table was a marshmallow. And they were told, "This is your marshmallow, it's for you. You can eat it anytime you want. But if you will wait," the researcher told them, "if you will wait for just 1 minute, I need to go down the hall and run an errand, and I will be back in a minute. And when I get back, if you can save the marshmallow till I get back, I'll give you another one. And so you'll have two. And they'll be yours. You can eat them whenever you want." So the researcher left the room, and you can imagine what the scene was like. Some of the kids, as soon as the door was shut, they grabbed the marshmallow and gobbled it down. And there were others who tried to wait, and it was such agony, they just couldn't manage it. And then there were those who managed to wait it out. Some of them sang to themselves. Some of them looked around the room or danced around a bit. One kid fell asleep. It only took a minute. And the researcher came back, and those who had waited got a second marshmallow. But the results of the study didn't come out for many years, because what happened next was they waited for those children to grow up a little more. And when they were in high school, they went back and examined what they were like and what their lives were like. And they discovered this. The four-year-olds who had the fortitude to hold out and wait for the second marshmallow, they grew up to be better adjusted, more popular, more adventurous, more confident, more dependable teenagers. The children who couldn't wait, who gave in to the temptation, were more likely to be lonely. They were more likely to be easily frustrated and stubborn. They buckled under stress and shied away from challenges. And when some of the students from those two groups took the scholastic aptitude test, they found that the kids who had held out longer and waited for the second marshmallow, scored an average of 210 points higher than the other kids on the SATs. The ability to resist temptation, the ability to delay gratification, the ability to control one's urges is one of life's greatest success skills. It's something that we learn. And, well, according to this study at least, it's something we learn with some urgency. The mother of a young child approached Robert E. Lee one day, a man of deep character, and she asked him, "What is the greatest lesson I can teach my child as he grows up?" And Lee's immediate response was this: "Teach him to deny himself." Today we might say it differently. We might say, teach him to delay gratification. Teach him to resist some of the urges that he might feel. Teach him to deny himself, the great general said. But we live in a world that encourages just the opposite. Our culture encourages us to live beyond our means. We are tempted to have it now and pay for it later, as opposed to saving and being good stewards of our resources. We are caught in a culture of instant gratification, and the struggle in one way or another affects every one of us. No one is exempt. The insights of the famous marshmallow experiment and the wise counsel of Robert E. Lee tend to fall on deaf ears these days. Adam Hamilton told a story about several years ago, the Royal Bank of Scotland sent an offer for a gold MasterCard to Monty Slater. And when they sent the offer to Monty, it included with it a credit limit of $20,000. A remarkable credit limit for a first-time customer and a first-time card. And it's particularly remarkable when you consider that Monty Slater was a dog. He was a Shih Tzu dog. And Raymond, the owner of the dog, thought about using the MasterCard for some of Monty's favorite treats. But he reconsidered, recognizing that the pup was not in a position to pay the balance when it came due. And if he didn't pay the balance, it would adversely affect his credit rating. Our culture encourages us to live beyond our means. Instant gratification. Have it now. Pay for it later. As opposed to saving and being good stewards of our resources. As I was coming from my home into the church the other day, I heard a commentator on the radio talking about the American dream. And as he made his way into his remarks, I found myself to be more and more disappointed in what he had to say. Because I'm aware, as you are aware, that when we talk about the American dream, there have been some lofty, wondrous dreams that we have dreams. Our founders had a dream. They called it life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And then there was the dream of freedom and new beginnings that is so beautifully expressed in the inscription on the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to be free, yearning to breathe free. Then there's the dream of unity, unity of purpose, unity in achievement, and unity in sacrifice that great leaders like Frederick Douglass and Abraham Lincoln talked about. There's the dream of equality and opportunity conveyed by such contemporary leaders as Martin Luther King. I have a dream, he said, that one day this nation will live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all are created equal. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they'll be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. And it was Dr. King also who tied this dream to an even larger dream expressed by the prophets of the Hebrew Scripture. I have a dream, he said, that one day every valley shall be exalted. Every hill and mountain shall be made low. The rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it together. These are great dreams, lofty dreams, but they are generally not what people mean when we hear the expression, the American dream today. For most people, the American dream has to do with simple individual freedom and material wealth, hardly the things of which great dreams, lofty aspirations are made. But the American dream has devalued itself and become merely the opportunity to pursue more things, to gain more, and to meet success. And we tend to measure success by the stuff that we possess. We have tended to abandon the loftier dreams of our nation's founders and our great leaders, and we have made success and wealth our great dream. And now this dream has become a nightmare. As we have seen economies falling apart, families losing homes and jobs and health care coverage, indeed, the entire world reeling at the losses. Adam Hamilton points to two illnesses that he identifies which have made our American dream into a nightmare. He says the first illness is called affluenza. Perhaps you've heard of influenza. This is affluenza. Affluenza is the constant need for more and bigger and better stuff. Most of us have been infected by this virus to some degree. It is no secret that one of America's favorite pastimes is shopping. Shopping has become an American way of life, and our economy is dependent upon consumer spending, which is why it is measured and reported every night on the news. We tune in to hear about the impact of consumer spending on the stock market and our retirement funds, and we're even told that our spending determines the strength of our nation. Every newspaper we pick up, every television show we watch is filled with advertisements for which someone paid thousands, if not millions of dollars, in the hope of convincing us that there's something else that we need. And they're pretty good at it, too. A recent article, according to the National Home Builders Association, said that the average American home went from 1,600 square feet in 1973 to 2,400 square feet in 2004, a 50% increase in a mere 30 years. And yet, we still don't have enough space to store all our stuff. One of the fastest growing industries in our nation is the self-storage business, and there are an estimated 1.9 billion square feet of self-storage facilities in this country, an entire market developed around storing the stuff that we're enticed to buy that we don't have room for and haven't yet paid for. Affluenza. But there's a second disease that has infected us that goes along with affluenza, and it is called creditis. Are you afflicted with creditis? The opportunity to buy now and pay later. It's basically the idea that you can enjoy something today and pay for it tomorrow, and it feeds our need for instant gratification. Creditis has exploited our lack of self-discipline and allowed us to feed our affluenza. It has wreaked havoc with our personal and our national finances. In 1990, the average credit card debt for an individual American or family was $3,000. Today, it's over $9,000. The savings rate has plummeted. 20 years ago, the average amount of savings that an American family had was 10% of their annual income. Until January of this year, it was negative. And now, in the last few months, Art Davis just told me this morning, in the last few months, the savings rate has climbed back up to 8%. And he told me, it's like the individuals and families in this country are trying to show the government how to live and how to handle this credit crisis that we're in. You save, that is the answer. Not more borrowing, but saving. I can't talk to you about the national debt because I don't have a page big enough to hold that many numbers. And I know that billion comes after million and trillion comes after billion, but I don't know what comes after that. And I'm afraid that's where we are. From our houses to our cars, from computers to college educations, from furniture to clothing, we are deeper in debt than we ever imagined we would be. All this leads to debt collectors and personal bankruptcies, not to mention tremendous stress. One researcher reported that the number one cause of divorce is financial issues. We are suffering the consequences of our addiction to consumption and our compulsion toward buying, and yet our desire for more is never satisfied. That's because there's a deeper problem. We began to talk about this last week, and I want to say another word about it this week. There's another problem, a spiritual problem that underlies all of this financial mess. A spiritual issue that lies beneath the surface of affluenza and underneath creditis. It's nothing new. It's been a part of the human family from the very beginning. Inside us, the scripture instructs us, inside of us there is a brokenness that the Bible calls sin. Our souls were created in the image of God, and they have been distorted. We were meant to desire God, but we have turned that desire toward possessions. We were meant to find our security in God, but now we find it in amassing wealth. We were meant to love people, but instead we compete with them. We were meant to be generous and to share with those in need, but now we selfishly hoard our resources for ourselves. Inside of us there is a brokenness called sin, and all of these things are evidence that we are infected by it. If you are in debt, the scripture tells us, if you are in debt, you are a slave. If you spend all you have, you will never offer your tithes to God. You will not help the poor as you could have. You will not use your resources to accomplish God's purposes if you are overly in debt. If you are a slave to creditors, you will not know simplicity and generosity and joy. Your effectiveness to God's kingdom will be neutralized and the gospel will be choked out of your life. Our spiritual lives remain immature and unfruitful so long as we pursue the American dream dictated by our culture. We are not thinking about the things of God as the creditors are calling. We can't experience the blessing and joy that comes from giving freely when we can't make ends meet. We can't be still and know that God is God because we've got too many gadgets we listen to day by day. Jesus and his followers were at Caesarea Philippi. Their ministry to that point had been a stunning success. Crowds pressed in on them from everywhere. People eagerly reached out to touch this engaging young carpenter from Nazareth. The disciples themselves were caught up in the excitement of it all. Jesus asked them, "Who do you say that I am?" And eventually Simon Peter's enthusiastic response came, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." It was one of the most dramatic moments in Jesus' pilgrimage with his disciples. But then Jesus changed the subject. And that's where we picked up this morning in Matthew 16. He changed the subject. He began to tell them that very soon the crowds would disappear and people would turn against him. He would be tortured and crucified. He would die. But on the third day, he would be raised. And the disciples didn't know what to make of all this. Peter took him aside, and it says, Peter rebuked him. He said, "Never, Lord, this shall never happen to you." But Jesus turned to Peter, and you know what he said. It was a stunning rebuke. "Get behind me, Satan, for you are thinking not of divine things, but of human things." And then Jesus said something to his followers that was quite stark. And I think that if Jesus stood here among us today, he would say these words to us. They are so pointed and so appropriate. "If anyone would come after me, if anyone would follow me, he must deny himself and take up his cross and follow me. For whoever wants to save her life will lose it, but whoever loses her life for me will find it. For what will it profit you? What will it profit you if you buy the whole world, but you lose your soul? What good is it if you have the power and the credit cards to buy every desire of your heart? To have those possessions and hold them, what good is it if you lose your life, your soul, in the process?" If Jesus could speak to us now, I'm confident those are among the things that he would direct at us. Because they call us, those words call us to reflect on the ways that we live and the values that we put into practice. What good is it? What will it profit you if you gain the whole world but forfeit your soul? Of what value is it that we possess everything that our heart desires, but there's no joy in that heart? The joy of life, the joy for others, the joy of giving, the joy of generosity. Where is the joy in life that God intended if you spend all your time and all your energy trying to salvage yourself from debt, rather than adding value to your life and to the lives of others by serving and loving and giving? Richard Leakey was a remarkable archaeologist, probably one of the greatest scientists of the last century. He studied the origins of humans and other species of animals and did much of his work in Africa, in northern Kenya. In one of his books, there is a discussion as he reflects on his work. He discusses what it is that separates human beings and makes human beings different from the great apes. And he says, you know, physically we have many similar characteristics. We both walk upright, for example. Physically we have many characteristics. The structure of our brains is very much the same if you dissect them and take them apart. The great apes can learn to use tools just like human beings do. Not as complex as human beings do, but tools just the same. There are many similarities between us and our closest relatives in the world, the great apes. He said, but there's one remarkable thing that makes us different. There's one thing that sticks out above all others that is most different. It is not intelligence. Intelligence is not the thing that separates us, but rather it is the human ability to be generous. Only human beings have the ability to give and to share. Only human beings are capable of genuine compassion. Only a human being is capable of laying down his or her life for another. The thing that makes us different from all the other creatures on the earth, the thing that makes us most different, is our ability to give, to be generous. You may have heard of the, I'm sure you've heard of the Christian sect called the Shakers. They are known for their simplicity, and most people, when they hear the term Shakers, they think of Shaker furniture, because Shaker furniture is very plain. It does not have the flourishes that and the decoration that other furniture has, but Shaker furniture is very beautiful and well-crafted. Well, the Shakers were well-known for their songs and their dancing and their joy. They worked hard to keep their life unadorned and uncomplicated so that they could experience the joy and the generosity and the love that they believed God intended. They produced a song, a very well-known song called Simple Gifts, that we will sing in just a moment. It was written in 1848 by Elder Joseph Brackett. It is a song which people sang as they danced and as they worshiped, and it captures an invitation to simplicity. Over the past 2 weeks, last week and today, we've begun to talk about what it is to live a life of generosity and simplicity. And last week and today, it's been a bit theoretical and theological. In the next few weeks, we're going to get to some practical things. Some practical things that you and I can do to structure our lives so that we can live simply and generously. And by doing so, by doing these things, we trust that we find the joy that God intended for us. The joy and simplicity and generosity that there is. The very joy that we sing about in the old Shaker tune, Simple Gifts. Would you sing it with me now?